This video is sponsored by Skillshare. I'm gonna start by showing you two pictures, this one and this one. I'll start with this one. This is James Ingraham and his mother. Back in 1970, James Ingraham was a student at a junior high school in Florida when he got called into the principal's office after he left the school auditorium too slowly. What happened next was brutal. The principal of the school and all the staff members pinned him down and paddled him. And it wasn't just once or twice, it was more than 20 times. The beating was so severe that James needed medical attention. So in 1971, parents gathered and a lawsuit was filed on their behalf. They argued that paddling kids like this wasn't just unfair, it was unconstitutional. The case claimed that corporal punishment in schools violated the 8th Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, as well as the 14th Amendment's guarantee of due process. Their demand was very simple. Students should at least get a chance to defend themselves before being physically punished. The courts, however, did not agree. In November 1976, it made its way to the US Supreme Court. When the ruling came down the following year, it wasn't the outcome Ingraham and his supporters had hoped for. Writing for the majority, Justice Lewis F. Powell Jr. explained that the Eighth Amendment's protections only applied to, wait for it, convicted criminals, not students. And with that, the Supreme Court essentially gave schools the green light to continue using corporal punishment on students. Today, corporal punishment is still legal in 14 states in the US. So for example, in May 2009 in Temple, Texas, the school board unanimously voted to revive the use of the paddle in the town's 14 schools. Parents not only supported the measure, they encouraged the school board to reconsider the paddling policy because many Temple parents who paddle their children at home wanted consistent discipline in the classroom. Speaking of parents turning a blind eye to mistreatment, I want to show you this second picture. This is Betaram. If you've been following the news in France, maybe you've heard of it. Betaram is a private school in the south of France that is known for being quite strict. In an investigation, the media Mediapart showed that what happens behind those walls is far worse than anyone imagined. Former students have come forward with horrifying testimonies. Some say they were locked outside in the cold as punishment. Others were physically or abused. I won't go into details, but trust me, it's beyond disturbing. And parents weren't completely unaware. Take Patrice, a former student. He recalls being slapped by the school's director, a religious figure, right in front of his parents, who didn't say anything. In fact, many victims said that nobody would believe them when they reported what happened. It's now 2025 and these allegations go back decades. And now things are getting even more political because our new Prime Minister, François Bayrou, is deeply involved, deeply entangled in this scandal. His wife worked at Betaram. One of his children went there. And despite visiting the school in 1996 while serving as Minister of Education, he claimed he was unaware of the complaints. But Mediapart, the media that did the whole investigation, has receipts, proof that he knew and did nothing. Now, the stories behind these two pictures are, in the end, very similar. It's the story of powerful institutions taking advantage of vulnerable individuals, using the worst forms of punishment to discipline them. These stories leave us with one question. Why are we so scared of kids?
Congressional Democrats are fighting to keep the doors of the Education Department open.
The left-wing gender insanity being pushed on our children is an act of child abuse. Very simple. Here's my plan to stop the chemical, physical, and emotional mutilation of our youth.
French film director Christophe Ruggier has called the accusations pure lies. A three-judge panel has found Ruggier guilty of assaulting the now 35-year-old actor when she was between the ages of 12 and 14.
At this time, we are conducting a review. No materials have been permanently removed from our school libraries pending completion of the review.
The people that judge me or my parent in, I don't really care. What can school give them that I can't?
Education.
In this video, I want to consider everything that is happening in society right now. So the defunding of education in the US, gentle parenting, trans rights, especially trans kids' rights, book censorships, etc., etc. And I want to show how all those things are actually connected. But before I do that, I need to introduce you to today's sponsor, Skillshare. I'm always trying to find new ways to get better at writing essays, you know, crafting stories that really resonate with people. A few years ago, I joined Skillshare to do Roxane Gay's tutorial, and lately I've been delving into writing personal essays with impact by Sari Botton. and it's been great so far. She breaks down how to find your voice, how to structure your essays, and make your writing more compelling. If you're not familiar, Skillshare is the largest online learning community for creatives with thousands of classes led by industry experts. Whether you're into writing, film, illustration, animation, design, there will be something for everyone. I love to get inspired by other creative people, and I usually find that on traditional social media platforms, but lately, yeah, I feel like they encourage everything but creative thinking or creative practices. So yeah, I found myself spending much more time on Skillshare. Now, if you feel like trying Skillshare, let me tell you that the first 500 people to use my link in the description will get a 1 month free trial. Why not give it a shot? You can click the link in the description and start learning today. Thank you, Skillshare, for sponsoring the video. And yeah, let's go back to it. Okay, so let's go back to Temple, Texas. In the 2010s, the school board voted to bring back the paddle with parents' support. Temple's assistant superintendent, John Hancock, explained that, quote, "We are rural Central Texas. We're very well educated, but still, there are those core values. You know, churches are full on Sundays." This explanation is interesting. Hancock justifies corporal punishment by claiming that it aligns with their core values, religious values. It's interesting because it reminds us how guilt and punishment are at the core of Christianity. Parents feel guilty for their and their kids' bad behavior and are willing to punish themselves and their kids in order to be saved. This is very clear in a community like Temple, Texas, which is religious and conservative. But that doesn't mean that non-religious people don't suffer from those same problems, those same tendencies. The influence of Christianity extends beyond religious communities. It has been shaping Western societies for centuries now. Like, have you ever wondered where that harsh, critical voice in your head comes from? Why so many people struggle with guilt and self-doubt, especially in the Western world? Some think it has a lot to do with religion, specifically the idea that we're all miserable creatures. For centuries, Christian preachers hammered this message in, telling people they were born sinners, that their desires were shameful, and that they had to constantly keep themselves in check to avoid hell. At the root of it all is the concept of original sin, which was actually invented by Saint Augustine in the 4th century. He argued that Adam and Eve's mistake wasn't just theirs. It got passed down to all of us, making every human guilty from birth. He pushed to make this idea official, and in 418, the church adopted it. His reasoning? If God is good, then evil must be humanity's fault. This idea shaped not only religion, but all of Western culture. It justified things like male dominance, corporal punishment, work exploitation, etc., etc. Now, some did argue against this pessimistic view of religion. Julian of Eclanum, a bishop and follower of Pelagius, said that people are born innocent and free to make their own choices. He thought the idea that Adam's sin somehow broke the universe was ridiculous. His view was way more optimistic. Humans aren't doomed. They're just another species figuring things out. But Saint Augustine's version won. His grim take that humans are hopelessly flawed and need strict control worked perfectly for the church, which by then had become the official religion of the Roman Empire. Christianity wasn't a rebellious underground movement anymore. It was part of the system, and rulers loved the idea that people were too sinful to govern themselves. It made them easier to control. So people started working against their communities by policing individuals in the hope of buying back their guilt. During the witch hunts, husbands and fathers helped officials find these so-called witches in their homes. During the Second World War, locals reported their Jewish neighbors and the people who hid them. And in Temple, parents asked the school board to bring back the paddle in schools. In our culture of guilt, where all humans are born sinners, children are especially scrutinized. Like Adam and Eve, the creation of God, children are perceived as inherently mean and corruptible. Us adults have been disciplined by institutions like the family, the church, the school, the workplace. But children, on the other hand, just came into this world. They don't obey as willingly and try to corrupt adults. Take the example of Lolita. Since the publication of Lolita by Nabokov, the theme of girls seducing adult men has been mobilized in a lot of cultural productions. Most of the time, the story is told through the perspective of the predator, who present themselves as the victim of the flirtatious kid. Things are changing now because more and more girls are explaining how those grown men use their aura to take advantage of them. It wasn't love, many said. It was an abuse of power. Interestingly, those who defend those powerful men against cancel culture, tend to be the same people who warn against the sexualization of kids by progressives. Protect our kids, say conservatives, against homosexuals in the 1980s, against transgenderism and drag queen story hour since the 2010s. Protect our kids while we elect convicted predators. I know it sounds paradoxical, but it actually makes a lot of sense. I think it's pretty clear that when conservatives say protect our kids, what they mean is more control to parents. The activism targets schools, libraries, or sports, meaning spaces where kids might come across different life experiences that may contradict their worldview. The child's exposition to ideas and experiences must therefore be limited to stay aligned with the family's values. Families want to be able to discipline their kids the way they want. I mean, think about Temple's parents bringing back the paddle in alignment with their community's core values. Those parents believe that corporal punishment in the form of hitting a child's buttocks with a paddle is okay because it leads to a more disciplined community. I mean, I'm sure those parents wouldn't say that they are violent. Why? Because they draw a line between legitimate violence, aka discipline, and illegitimate violence, aka abuse. The kid, though, doesn't necessarily make that distinction. If something hurts, it hurts. Quote, children are not passive recipients of adult logic. They are thinking and reasoning subjects, and they are not automatically going to accept the artificial lines drawn by adults between acceptable and unacceptable ways of coercively touching them. End quote. So this was a quote from an essay by Narcissus posted on the blog Humour Autonome. I found it thanks to Andrew from the channel Andrewism. Great channel, highly recommend. Basically, I was looking for a way to answer the questions of who is really protecting children in this world? What does it mean to protect? Do we want children to be safe or to be free? Now, currently, it seems that we have two ideological blocks. On the one hand, we have conservative parents who want to protect kids from hypersexualization while legitimizing the worst forms of discipline as well as protecting powerful people's abuse. On the other hand, progressives who want to empower young people by treating them like thinking and reasoning beings, but are then accused of exposing kids to unsafe environments and hypersexualization. There are paradoxes in those two senses. We say that conservatives want to keep children safe, but they end up limiting their freedom. Or we say that progressives want to give more freedom to children, but end up making them unsafe. The thing is, these are false paradoxes. They are false paradoxes because they suppose that freedom and safety cannot fully coexist. We can't have both, basically. Funnily enough, this false paradox is also applied to women. We often hear that as women, we should avoid certain areas, we shouldn't go out too late at night, that we shouldn't wear certain clothes because doing the opposite would be unsafe. Some people even believe that women should submit to men in exchange for protection. In their essay, Narcissus argues that we shouldn't have to choose between safety and freedom. But it's impossible to have this conversation in our current media space. Why? Because we're stuck with those false paradoxes. You see, every time someone tries to make a case for children's freedom, moral concerns like the fear of exposing children to abuse, especially sexual abuse, take over. And because no one wants kids to go through that, we just leave the conversation where it is and go back to business as usual. In their essay, though, Narcissus tries to go beyond the moral concerns, the emotions, to find a solution. To do so, they chose to focus on the idea of body autonomy. They explain that the message we tell children is that body autonomy is something only adults can have. Only adults can say no to people touching them. Only adults can consent. So if you're a child and you want to be treated as a free, autonomous person, then you must find a way to escape childhood. So that's the first point. Now, it is true that in our societies, sexuality plays a huge role in separating adults from children. When MAGA says that we need to protect children, they mean protecting children from those supposed LGBTQ+ predators. When MAGA goes crazy with trans women in public bathrooms, it's because they want to prevent vulnerable women and girls from being sexualized by supposed men in disguise. So they're telling us, including children, that being an adult means to be sexually available to adults. As people who want to protect children, we then must prevent them from being sexually active, which means taking away their ability to consent to sex. That's why a lot of countries have an age of consent. Now, this is good, because that means that if someone wants to take advantage of children, they can't do that legally because the child cannot consent, so the interaction will always be non-consensual. A child cannot say yes. But there's an issue here, you see. Consent isn't just the ability to say yes. It's also the ability to say no. So when we say that children cannot consent, we say that they can't say yes, but we also say that they can't say no. Now this says something about us as a society. Our laws say that we're scared of people who might take advantage of children, but they say something else. They say that we're also scared of children asserting their body autonomy by saying no. We're scared of the prospect of kids having body autonomy because we want to have power over them. We want to shape them into little extensions of ourselves. We want to be able to use any tool of coercion we might see fit. Corporal punishment, psychological violence, with the knowledge that the child won't and cannot say no. Now, I want to make it clear that increasing the autonomy of a vulnerable person does not diminish the ethical obligations of adults at all. Quote, "The function of this rhetorical trick, basically people saying that if children deserve rights, that means adults can sexualize them, is to act as a threat. It is a threat routinely deployed against anyone who seeks any kind of liberation. Let's take another example. People saying things like, if women are equal, that means I can hit them. It is a threat. It is meant to keep us as second-class citizens by equating more body autonomy to less safety. It tells us that giving away some of our body autonomy in exchange for protection is the only way to keep us safe. But we know that is not the case. I mean, look at the statistics. Most of the victims of sexual violence are very young. Things like child marriage, grooming, and other forms of suppression and violence are overwhelmingly committed by the same authority figures that are supposed to protect them. Parents, foster parents, teachers, policemen, priests, and so on. I know it's tough to hear this because we develop emotional attachment to those people. They are our carers, so we don't want to think that they are bad people. But that's precisely why we need to have this difficult conversation, that honesty should empower us to foster change so that we can love fully and not love in denial of the hurt we feel and we hide. Now, some people have already embraced that change. One potential solution has been pushed forward in recent years and has received its fair share of criticism. It's time to talk about gentle parenting. So when I started doing the research for this video, I stumbled upon a lot of content on gentle parenting. Every single major news outlet has something to say about it. So before I move on with this topic, I'd like to send a message to legacy media. Why is there so much discourse and op-eds on gentle parenting, but so little coverage of childhood violence? I'm not even joking. All the major outlets have the same critical opinion piece on gentle parenting. They're all written by overworked moms. They all start with an anecdote of one of their kids being annoying. They all say that gentle parenting is lenient, and they all conclude with something along the lines of, you are enough, it's okay to raise your voice at times. After reading this pieces, I thought, is someone helping these women? Is there a father around that overthinks as much as they overthink their parenting style? In fact, I should probably start this second part by saying that gentle parenting doesn't seem easy. Gentle parenting, which includes both the act of parenting, but also overthinking everything you say and do to your child for the rest of your day, plus the lack of affordable childcare, plus demanding jobs, plus commuting, plus inequalities in domestic work, that equals burnout, just straight up burnout. So of course, parents are more likely to resort back to more authoritative methods. It doesn't mean that gentle parenting is bad. It just means that it's not compatible with the pressures of life under late-stage capitalism. Now, the essays on gentle parenting I read did not really address this. They came across as attempts to mitigate the guilt these female writers and mothers feel. But the thing is that no one told them that they were bad mothers. Yet they still felt the need to justify themselves in an essay, in multiple essays. This, to me, says a lot about how internalized mothers' sense of guilt is. We're so harsh on mothers, there's always something to say about their parenting style, but little acknowledgement of all the domestic work that they do. It is time for a mother's strike, I'm just saying. Now that this has been said, I want to reconnect gentle parenting to the conversation we had in part one and produce my own criticism. I think that some of the things I talked about in part one apply to gentle parenting. And I know it sounds crazy to say this because gentle parenting is supposed to be the solution to conservative parenting, but I'm still gonna make my case. So what is the goal of gentle parenting? The goal of gentle parenting is to raise confident, independent, and happy children through empathy, respect, and understanding, and setting healthy boundaries. From what I've read, the gentle parenting influencer is Dr. Becky. Here is one of her takes.
Let's say it's the situation of somebody dying, and I'm upset. First of all, as a parent, tell yourself, it's not my kid seeing me sad that's going to destabilize them. It's seeing me sad and me making up a bogus story or denying it, because then my kid goes, pretty sure my mom was upset. Oh, she's not? Oh, she's pretending like nothing happened? Oh, she looks sad, but she's saying she's not sad. That is really upsetting. It would be like hearing your boss say, oh yeah, 20% layoffs. What are we doing? I don't know. Oh, hi, everything's great. How are you? What you'd want is your boss say, you just heard something. You were right to hear that. We are about to go through a really tough time. I'm stressed about it. That's why I yelled. You might be stressed. Here's what I know. This is going to be hard and we're going to get through it together. Now, all of a sudden, that emotional experience has a container.
So Dr. Becky gives her viewers a bunch of scripts, as she calls them, scripts to follow so that when a situation occurs, the parent can know exactly what to do. They can connect the situation to the right script. It's kind of like a video game. You select the right dialogue box and you hope for the best. The only issue is that in real life, selecting the wrong dialogue box can have bad consequences. In the case of parenting, choosing the wrong script can be seen as a massive failure that will have repercussions for the rest of the child's life.
I mentioned in my last video that I went clothes shopping for my children, and a lot of people are shocked to hear that I have children, considering I sued my parents for having me without my permission.
Obviously, this is an overgeneralization, but many parents do feel anxious about the long-term consequences of their parenting choices. Now, don't get me wrong, I think scripts can be super helpful, especially for those of us who have issues with social cues, etc. And I understand how helpful they can be in therapy or counseling to help clients. But, it's not because something works in certain contexts that it cannot be improved. In fact, I would even argue that for all the help that they bring, those scripts can also cause a lot of frustrations because there are many cases where the script just doesn't work. So let's take a second and think about how an engineer would think about this. We have a system that works in most cases, but not in all cases. So we want to improve it, right? Well, as social scientists, we do the exact same thing. We look at an issue in society, in human relations, and we try to find a way to improve it. So how can we improve parenting? Well, gentle parenting goes in one direction, it's a proposition, but the success rate doesn't seem good enough. Why? Well, I think we're lacking perspective once again. Gentle parenting, like conservative parenting, looks at parenting as a system evolving two entities, parents and kids. The success of parenting depends on parents picking the right scripts. We could also say that parents must make the right choices. This is where all the focus is put, on individual choices based on an individual assessment of a given situation. The person choosing the script takes the responsibility of everything that will happen after the script is chosen. So here's a question for you now. How much control can a person have over a given situation? Like, can an assessment of each other's psychology be enough to manage the situation? Aren't there other elements outside the psychology of the individuals involved that could have an impact on the outcome of a situation? I'll give you a few seconds to think about this. Yes, they are. I believe they are because I believe that our actions and choices are conditioned not just by our psyche, not just about the psyche of the people involved in the situation, but also by external circumstances that I have no power over. The choices we make on a daily basis aren't made freely. They are conditioned by a variety of factors that have nothing to do with individual psychology. Let's take another example. If someone is depressed because they can't get a medical procedure that would mean a lot to them, we can help this person feel psychologically better. We can encourage the people around that person to be supportive. But ultimately, the thing that is making that person depressed is outside of their control. Maybe the law is preventing them from accessing the procedure. Maybe their lack of opportunities is restricting their capacity to afford the procedure. It has nothing to do with their psychology, rather their conditions of existence, or what we also call material conditions, are the problem. In the case of gentle parenting, the scripts that are given to parents don't take into consideration those external elements that make the application of the scripts sometimes unsuccessful. One of those external elements is something we talked about in part one, the lack of body autonomy of the kid, aka the ability for kids to say no and be heard when someone does something wrong to them. You see, gentle parenting is supposed to foster the child's independence. Yet the child is constantly monitored by the same one or two people. You know what? I found this comparison Dr. Becky made in the clip I showed earlier quite interesting. She compared an interaction with her child to an interaction with a boss. Let's refresh our memory. I'll show you the clip again.
Let's say it's the situation of somebody dying and I'm upset. First of all, as a parent, tell yourself, it's not my kid seeing me sad that's going to destabilize them. It's seeing me sad and me making up a bogus story or denying it, because then my kid goes, pretty sure my mom was upset. Oh, she's not? Oh, she's pretending like nothing happened? Oh, she looks sad, but she's saying she's not sad. That is really upsetting. It would be like hearing your boss say, oh yeah, 20% layoffs. What are we doing? I don't know. Oh, hi, everything's great. How are you? What you'd want is your boss say, you just heard something. You were right to hear that. We are about to go through a really tough time. I'm stressed about it. That's why I yelled. You might be stressed. Here's what I know. This is going to be hard and we're going to get through it together. Now, all of a sudden, that emotional experience has a container.
In both cases, the leader, the boss, or the parents share how they feel to encourage empathy and honesty. Dr. Becky implies that being honest about how we feel will lead to other people around us being more honest about how they feel. But this clearly doesn't take into account the power dynamics at play in society. The external factors we talked about earlier. The employee will certainly appreciate their boss' honesty, but the employee knows that they cannot reciprocate that level of honesty because the boss has power over their employees. That means that being too honest, too independent, too free can backfire. When we're at work, we cannot be ourselves fully. Some are even encouraged to give up themselves completely and become slave to work. They've lost all body autonomy, the ability to make choices for themselves. They just obey to managers and bosses. Now the child of gentle parents can find themselves in a similar situation. They are encouraged to share and be open, but they're also deeply aware of the unequal relationship that they have with their parents. Now I'm not saying that kids should evolve with zero authority. I'm not saying that. I just want to highlight how central the authority is. The parent is like the panopticon. It overlooks everything the child does. It overanalyzes everything the child says and responds with pre-made scripts found in books or Instagram posts. So while gentle parenting is very different from conservative parenting, both rely on a central figure of authority shaping the life of an individual whose body autonomy is constrained. The sociologist Bernard Lahire points out that humans are the only species with such a long period of development outside the womb, which comes with a lot of vulnerability and a prolonged dependence on parents. He explains that the relationship between parents and children is built on, quote, mutual attachment and protection, but also, whether one likes it or not, whether one resists it or not, a relationship of domination, end quote. Now, if gentle parenting isn't the solution, then what can we do? I think that on an individual level, having more people involved in the parenting process can be beneficial. The neoliberal family is a very small unit, so fighting against that means extending families beyond kinship. That means getting friends involved, for example. Unfortunately, those strategies are hard to put in place for the same reasons that gentle parenting is hard. People are busy, mobile, less stable. So we need some pretty significant changes in the way society is structured. We need to give people the time and resources to raise children collectively with our differences. Thank you for watching. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, the conversation continues in the comments section. Don't forget to like, to subscribe if it's not already done. Before I leave, I would like to thank my patrons for their support and a special thank to top tier patrons. Paul Louis, George, Wolfgratz, Patrick Button, Jeff Lee, Yilan, Taya Matin, Nick, Brandon, James Siddle, Pablo, Patrick, Boris, Ria, Corrigi, Tristan, Christopher, Ian, Donage, Alex, Manuel, Christopher France, and Perry. And thank you to the other ones who prefer to stay anonymous. I think that's it for me. Thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring the video. Thank you to Skillshare for sponsoring the video. And yeah, I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye. Did I say bye-bye? I meant salut.